Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. The usual two segments up today. First, in a little while, we'll speak with Deborah Meyer, who is a prominent teacher and education theorist, about what's going on with No Child Left Behind. We're hearing that the Obama administration will try to retain substantial portions of George Bush's signature education policy. What does that mean? What does all this testing mean? What is the point of education anyway? We'll talk to Deborah Meyer about all that. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with Adolf Reed, a frequent guest on this show, about genetics and politics and politics without politics, the Obama administration, and all sorts of other related material. Before all that, some words about the economic news. We are experiencing some trouble lately for the green shoots of recovery thesis. Early in the week, we learned that retail sales fell by an unexpectedly large 1.1% in March, or 0.9% if you leave out automobiles and light trucks. Sales had been up modestly in recent months, after plunging sharply late last year. In fact, while Wall Street loves to look at monthly changes, the year-to-year declines in retail sales are about the steepest on record. So the big decline that we saw in March punched a hole in hopes that the economy might be bottoming out. But since it's virtually certain the American economy has entered a new phase, one less dependent on consumption, we're not likely to see strong growth in retail sales anytime in the foreseeable future. Also, March saw a steep fall in industrial production, pretty much matching February's decline. And more bad news from the housing market, as housing starts fell unexpectedly in March. Most of the decline, though, was in apartment buildings. Groundbreaking a new single-family houses was flat for the month. But the news hasn't been all disappointing. The National Association of Home Builders Index, a composite measure of sales, traffic, and sentiment, rose strongly last month, though it's still at very low levels. And first-time claims for unemployment insurance, that sensitive indicator of the state of the job market, which I like to quote every week here, fell by 53,000 last week, a pretty healthy decline, though it might have been affected by the Good Friday holiday. You're supposed to adjust for that, but adjustments are never perfect. Still, this does comport with the image that the labor market's steep decline is slowing, somewhat at least. In any case, even if the economy is sort of stabilizing, which I think it is, it's not turning around anytime soon. So we're likely to see a mix of good and bad news in the coming weeks. Stay tuned. Meanwhile, the financial bailout continues to smell real bad. Early in the week, the Treasury's auditor, nicknamed the TARP cop, said that banks may have cooked their books in order to qualify for federal assistance. They were supposed to show that while they were sick, they weren't mortally so. Some banks are likely to have fudged the books to make themselves look healthier than they were. The TARP cop says indictments may be forthcoming. And now with J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs reporting strong results for the first quarter, you have to wonder if some of the better-off banks are exaggerating their health so they can get out of the TARP scheme so they can start paying their top executives more. The government is supposed to release details of the stress tests on the biggest banks in the coming days. We'll see if these results are detailed and credible. I suspect that the banks may now be sweeping their troubles under the rug out of self-interest, very narrow self-interest, that is, maximizing compensation for their top guys, which could cause problems in the future, especially if the signs of stabilization are a false dawn. We'll see. And oh, Goldman Sachs. On Friday, April 10, the Washington Examiner, a gossipy news website of right-wing leanings, ran a piece by Timothy Carney of their staff, reporting that Edward Liddy, the government-appointed head of the government-owned AIG, owns over $3 million in stock in Goldman Sachs. AIG, whose severe troubles threaten the stability of the global financial system, or what stability remains of it, has taken over $170 billion in federal aid so far. Some $13 billion of that has gone to, you guessed it, Goldman Sachs. And guess whose board Liddy served on until he was appointed to run AIG? Goldman Sachs, of course. And who appointed Liddy? Former Treasury Secretary Henry Hank Paulson, whose previous job was as co-chair of Goldman Sachs. Whom did Paulson appoint to run the financial bailout? Neil Kashkari, a former investment banker at Goldman Sachs. Kashkari, nicknamed Cash and Carry by some, was an aerospace engineer whose specialty at Goldman was raising funds and arranging mergers for high-tech firms. His previous job was as an aerospace engineer who worked, among other things, on space telescopes. In other words, his main qualification for running a $700 billion program seems to have been his previous employment at Goldman Sachs. But, as they say on TV, that's not all. Paulson has predecessors. Bill Clinton's Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin is a former Goldman co-chair, as is New Jersey Governor John Corzine, but he's busier trying to plug holes in his state budget than he is handing out bailout money. And Bush's chief of staff and his director of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission were both Goldman alums. And back in January, Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner appointed as his chief of staff a former lobbyist for Goldman Sachs, the very same day he issued rules restricting the role of lobbyists at the Treasury. Geithner, the former president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, is very close to one of his predecessors at the New York Fed, Gerald Corrigan, who is now employed by Goldman Sachs. Is there a pattern here? Now, to be fair, if only for a moment, one of the major reasons for AIG's crisis was that it insured a boatload of exotic investment products that were supposed to be solid but went very sour. So bailing out AIG meant that the government had to make good on the promises that the firm couldn't keep. That's the reason for the big payments to Goldman, among others. But Goldman itself didn't fully trust AIG, so it bought other forms of insurance as a backstop, meaning that Goldman's actual exposure to an AIG collapse was slim to none. But it got the full $13 billion anyway. Don't private insurers try to find any excuse not to pay off a claim? Liddy certainly did when he ran Allstate, which he did between 1995 and 2006. Most notoriously, Liddy and Allstate got famous around New Orleans for evading payments to their customers whose houses and cars were wrecked by Hurricane Katrina. And these were people with no other options. They were in no position to say, hey, I don't trust Allstate, so I better hedge myself. But there is hope. Obama is reportedly thinking of replacing Neil Cash and Carry as head of the bailout with a new guy. He's from Merrill Lynch. That's diversity, Obama style. Okay, let's take a musical break.
We don't need no education. We don't need no thought control.
And then, of course, Pink Floyd, their classic song, Another Brick in the Wall. And, of course, we do need education, just not that brick in the wall kind that Pink Floyd was talking about in that song. We are now joined by Deborah Meyer, who is a longtime education reformer, experienced teacher, founder of schools, and now a distinguished fellow at NYU School of Education. Welcome to Behind the News, Deborah Meyer.
Hi there. I enjoyed your business report.
Oh, thank you very much.
That was you, right?
That was me, yes.
And I think this school reform is a lot like business reform these days.
Well, yeah, let's talk about that.
Uncanny resemblance.
I was very surprised to see reading the New York, well, maybe I shouldn't have been surprised, but reading the Times the other day that it looks like the Obama administration is planning to keep substantial portions of the Bush No Child Left Behind program. First of all, what are they likely to keep? What are they likely to change?
Well, let me first say that what's interesting about your just referring to your previous story is that all the actors come out of the world, or practically all the actors, come out of the world of finance and foundations. And, you know, that circle in education, almost none of them have had any previous experience in education. But they are experts on education just as they are on the economy. And
I was noticing on your website, which I should point out, deborahmeyer.com, that people seem to regard Bill Gates as some sort of educational expert, don't they?
Yes, naturally. All you have to be is very rich to be an expert.
Yes.
And probably in most cases, not to have gone to public schools. And to have attended Harvard, that helps, even if you dropped out. So anyway, I'm a little frustrated. But I don't think there's. I think they're going to fool around with changing how they count AYP. That's the annual yearly progress. They may. I think over the next year, there's going to be an attempt to get more national to try to make the state standards more uniform across states. And their tests more uniform across states, but I don't think besides that there'll be much. And they are putting more money into it. I think they will put more money into it.
But at the center,
the money is going into precisely some of what I consider to be the weakest links in the so-called reform agenda.
Yeah,
I'm lately calling it deform because I've always thought I was an education reformer, and I'm sort of. I either have to change the name for them or change the name for me.
Well, you always have to be wary when people in power use the term reform. There's an aspect of three-card Monty about that sort of thing. But at the center of it will still be testing, right?
Well, not only will we be testing, but yes, we will. And what's frustrating to me is that I think there's at least three things that NCLB has done that are really questionable, in which we have a lot of evidence for it, and I feel like the emperor wears no clothes. That it's an unarguable question that we've had now, 6 or 7 years of, and it started earlier than that. I mean, it goes back really 10 years to the Texas miracle and then the Chicago miracle. That we've had 10 years of ascendancy of an idea that has clearly not worked. And why we think that if we do it even more rigorously, it'll work better. I can't even think outside of the test makers and the people who were starting charter schools. Otherwise, I can't even think whose self-interest this is in. I mean, you know.
But these foundation and business types that you were talking about earlier, they love metrics, as they say, right? So you need numbers, and that's what tests are for.
But the numbers are all bad. I mean, the numbers are that, at least according to the only standard we have, which is also a test, NAEP, that we've had flat results for 10 years. And then actually, in the previous period, from about 1990 to 2000, we had increasing NAEP results, but since 2000, they've been pretty much flat in both reading and math.
NAEP is the National Assessment of Educational Progress.
It's the only test that's not given to every kid, but it's given to a sample of all kids nationally. The same test is given, so to speak, over this period. And the test results are pretty flat. There are a few states that are where they've gone up a little, but on the whole, it's been flat. Now, that's despite the fact that we've had an overwhelming focus on test-taking and prepping for tests. For that reason alone, even though I think that would be sad, for that reason alone, you'd think the test scores would go up.
One of the criticisms...
It's amazing to me that even with that... The test scores have been flat.
And one of the criticisms of this test-centered thing is that, you know, teachers teach to the test, and so
yes, but they're obviously not very good at that.
Yeah, what's happening? Why aren't the tests?
I don't know because I would like to think it's because they're not teaching to the test, but alas, I have no evidence for that. I do also know that it's at the cost of our having largely eliminated art, history, phys ed, music, and social skills from our agenda. Of starting in pre-K, it's largely led to the fact that we now expel pre-kindergarten and kindergarten boys because we expect them to sit still for 5 hours doing literacy skills.
What, they expel kindergarten boys?
Expel them. We're expelling a very large number of young boys because they act out. Of course they act out.
That's insane.
I know it's insane. So, and of course, the only kind of reasoning, if you will, intellectual skills we're teaching kids is to how to find the right bubble answer out of five. That's hardly a reasoning skill that should be the focus of a nation that wants inventive, curious, hardworking, creative people to face the 21st. century.
Well, what if we don't really want those kinds of people and we want automatons who will push the right buttons and follow orders? Is that the kind of educational system you design?
Yes, but I have a hard time with that theory. I mean, I really do think that a guy like Arne Duncan is well-meaning.
That's the education secretary.
Yeah. And while I think he, you know, did terrible things in Chicago, I really do think he's well-meaning. I think there's something in the mindset of these people that, as you were describing earlier, that they bring to this not even the mindset of the old factory work company manager. You know, they were producing something. I really kind of would like the old factory style almost, because they were making something, they were creating something, they were doing something, whereas I think we're being run today by people who think what we mean by 21st century skills is just manipulating abstractions, money, numbers, crunching numbers. And I think they've spent their lifetime crunching numbers, and they really think that's what equals smartness. You know what I'm trying to say? Yeah. I think they've mistaken the kind of smartness a democratic, vibrant society needs, whether it's economics or politics, for a kind of shallow, manipulative skill.
Now, you said Arne Duncan had done bad things in Chicago. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, they have, aside from the fact that they haven't produced anything good, I think they have, it's two ways. They have started a lot of new charters in place local public schools. It's the same direction Klein is taking, even though there is no evidence that charters produce higher test results. Now, I'm willing to buy that we ought to find another way to measure whether charters are doing a good job. But I think both in New York and Chicago, we just think that if it's the marketplace, we don't need to worry about whether the test scores are good, because the marketplace itself is good. So they're replacing public schools with, quote, marketplace schools. And
along those lines, I just the National Bureau of Economic Research published a paper today by two economists studying New York City charter schools, and they found after adjusting for possible self-selection issues in the people who apply to charter schools, the charter schools improve the math test scores by 0.09 standard deviations and reading by 0.04, which is about as close to nothing as you can get.
Yes, it's insignificant. And by the way, there is, in a way, and I say this about my own schools, there's no way in which they're not in some form selective, in the sense that someone has to do something. So they're always slightly selective. But even beyond that, what a scandalous goal for American education, that the only thing we're really counts seriously is test scores. Now, I think graduation rates count, but, you know, having run high schools in New York, I hate to tell you this, the higher the stakes are on a piece of data, I think there's a word for this, a law for this called Campbell's Law, the higher the stakes on a piece of data, the less reliable that piece of data becomes. If you start focusing on attendance, when the superintendent in New York said we all had to get better attendance in the high school division, we did. We just changed the period we took attendance from the third period, used to be the first period, and we changed it to the third period. Ingenuity works in many ways, but if you place the stakes high enough, then you focus people's attention on the piece of data that you're counting. And you distract us from what it really means to be a well-educated person and what schools desperately need to do to help kids come out of 12 years of incarceration as better people, better thinkers, better prepared to lead this nation. In a democracy, every single kid counts. And we can't afford to be losing as many as we are.
I should say I speak with Deborah Meyer, who is a renowned progressive educator and now at NYU. And, how do you explain this infatuation with charter schools?
I don't know. I think partly it's that people have always sort of thought private schools must be better. And second of all, I think they're fun to start. I think a lot of people are, in a sense, what I started at East Harlem was a regular public school, but it had a lot of the qualities of a charter school. I had a lot of freedom and so forth. And so I think a lot of rich people looking for some way to make a dent in society want to start their own schools. And a lot of them want to, there's also money to be made, they think, in starting chains of schools. First of all, a lot of them are paid very well. Look at Eve Moskowitz in New York City and what she's paid as the head of a charter network. So even if the school is a nonprofit, its executives and directors make money on them. But I think it's probably the fun of it. And, when Anthony Alvarado, 35 years ago, started to do that in East Harlem, he found a lot of teachers who thought it would be fun to do. And I thought I liked the idea of choice and greater autonomy and freedom, and I thought that was going to be the salvation of public education. And I wrote a piece of that sort for The Nation magazine, and I was very hopeful that that within the public sector, we could release that energy for public purposes. But seems to be headed in a different direction, and tests are the most manipulable. They apparently are not more manipulable than stocks and bonds.
Well, sometimes the stocks and bonds bite you back.
I think it's the same people and the same mindset that are at work here. And the thing that puzzles me is why the public isn't more outraged, why the press it doesn't catch on to this.
You can say that about lots of things in this country. But now, what about how much can the schools compensate for the intense inequality in educational and income backgrounds of the students who attend them?
They can make a difference. Obviously, you and I pass on everything we can to our kids, and if we have more to pass on, we pass on more. So there's nothing, and in a time of enormously increased inequity, you could say the fact that tests gaps aren't any greater is a triumph of public education, because you'd think in this last 20 years, as the incomes and the wealth of Americans has grown so disparate, that it would have even a worse impact on school results. But I think schools, the schools that I was involved with, had an extraordinary record of graduating kids from high school. And going on to college, and we didn't spend a heck of a lot more money, but we had a kind of energy and freedom to really design a school for the kids we had and to follow through on it and to work collectively together. Those kids are having a party on July, I think it's 11th, the first 10 graduating classes of the high school. Those kids are now in their 30s, late 20s and 30s.
That's the Central Park East School?
Secondary school, the high school, yeah.
And, okay, we've got about 5 minutes left. So you're a Secretary of Education. You're replacing Arne Duncan. What would you do?
I would, from the bully pulpit, talk about the importance of democracy and what kind of habits of mind schools need to invest. They need mindful, thoughtful teachers who exercise judgment in the presence of families and kids, and they need the support and attention of the adult community. And what the federal government can provide is a lot better research when it isn't trying to prove a point, and a lot better tools for our assessing kids, which is something that each local community could learn from, making a lot more available to us, and also doing a lot to shore up the inequities between the kids who come to school with very few external resources and kids that come to school with tons of external resources, so that they're on somewhat closer of a playing field. We'll never be a country in which everybody earns the same amount, after all. I wouldn't even want that. But I think schools can do something if they focus their attention in the right direction towards undermining the inequities through schooling by providing kids with the kind of respect for the intelligence they do bring with them and for the strengths that poor people bring with them. You know, poor kids come to school with a lot greater independence, experience having to solve things themselves. And we did away, not only don't we reward them, but we punish them for it, because we suddenly treat them in a more infantile manner than they've been treated at home, where they're coddled less at home. And we coddle them in the worst sense at school. We don't give that energy and street smarts a chance to really work to their advantage. And I think there's that part of it is bully pulpit helping us see and kids see and their families see the kids that we really have and how much strength they do have. And the other part is providing the resources that enable us to really tackle that. You know, it's the only field in the world where we think that one adult can teach 20 to 30 young people something important and get them to do it well. I mean, we don't do that when we want them to be a good musician. We have either one-on-one or maybe we have a music teacher who works with five flutists or violinists at a time. And that's when kids want to play that instrument. An editor works with a few authors at one time. But we think somehow or other that I can teach you mathematics 30 at a time. And I'm not teaching you mathematics, then I'm teaching you how to pretend that you are a mathematician. We need road tests. You know, you don't teach someone to drive without a road test. And I think the government can do a lot of help for us to develop road tests. And to develop road tests that are respected by the public and by legislators so that we know whether kids are well-educated.
And how much, we only got a minute left, but how much of this, our education system's problems result of a lack of funding? Are we spending enough money or just spending it in the wrong way?
Well, it's both. It's both. I don't know. I'm just reading a manuscript in which this guy argues we could get class sizes down to where they should be, which is really between 8 and 15, which is what private schools do. Isn't it marvelous that we think wealthy kids need small classes? And that we could really get those size reductions without a lot more money. I don't know if he's right. You know, he argues you'd save in so many other places. But, you know, if I want my kid to be a good violinist, I know that it's more expensive than if I just want him to pass a violin competency test, right? It just stands to reason. So I want the conditions in the school that rich people are willing to pay for. I think the rich people are probably right that it helps if their kids are really heard every day by the teacher. The teacher can really read their papers and then sit down and talk with them about it, even though it may not help their test scores.
All right, we have to bring it to a close there. Thank you for joining us, Deborah Meyer.
Well, I hope you keep on this subject.
Oh, I certainly will.
I do, and I just think there's a lot to be learned that are across the board about a lot of these subjects that we're talking about.
Yeah, I think we need to have a better political discussion
of
it as well.
Yeah, and, well, it's got to do with what we want for the 21st century, perhaps.
All right. And as I said earlier, you can check out Deborah Meyer's writings at her website, Deborah Meyer, MEIER.com, DeborahMeyer.com. Okay, let's take I've been speaking with Deborah Meyer, who is a renowned progressive educator and educational theorist. Let's take a break, and we'll be back to talk politics with Adolf Reed.
Hi, this is Harry Belafonte. You're listening to Community Radio in New York City, WBAI 99.5 FM. WBAI is listener-supported, so please, be generous. Thank you.
You give yourself to those who don't deserve you. You go where you are not supposed to be. I know someday that I am going to have you. Someday you'll have to give yourself to me.
Well, that was a bit of a musical break, but let's take another. But I should say, you are listening to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood at WBAI in New York. We're not only at 99.5 on your FM dial, but also on the web at WBAI.org. And if you visit that website, be sure to hit the donate button. We need your help. Okay, music first, then Adolf Reed. Thank you. And that was some of the String Quartet by Theodore W. Adorno, written when he was, I believe, 17 or 18 years old, performed by the Leipzig String Quartet. I play that because Adolf Reed, in this interview we're about to listen to, declares himself still a partisan, a loyalist of the Frankfurt School. And, of course, Adorno was a leading light of that school of thought. And I'm with Adolf on that, as I am with many things. And I saw a story in the Times, New York Times, by Nicholas Wade on the Thursday morning, suggesting that, gosh, all this stuff with explaining diseases through genes is not working out quite as well as we'd hoped, because, golly gee, things are a little more complicated than we thought. It's just not a one-on-one mapping of gene to effect. A lot of factors at work, a lot of genes at work. Really, really complicated. Surprise, surprise. But which reminded me that Adolf has been fulminating recently about the growing role of genetics in political science. So that's what gave me the idea of giving Adolf a call. So this is an interview recorded earlier on Thursday with Adolf Reed. Welcome, Adolf. We see on the front page of Thursday's New York Times that Nicholas Wade, who has been a vulgar genetic determinist of a very low sort, disclosing that maybe this genetics thing is a little more complicated than we'd thought. Now, you've been observing the genetic theorizing in the political science profession. What's been going on there?
Well, the latest, I guess, or the most recent, is a rising tide of genetic of seeking for or claiming to have found genetic determinations of various facets of political action. The American Political Science Review, which is the flagship journal in the discipline, about 4 years ago published an article by several clowns who presumed that they had found a genetic foundation or basis for political orientation or for ideological orientation. And more recently, in this past summer, the APSR published another article by a different set of clowns that purports to have identified specific genetic sources that determine voting behavior or and voter turnout. I mean, this stuff is, would be laughably preposterous if people weren't taking it seriously. But it also fits a tale type, I guess, to get all folkloric about it, of scientific racism or determinist quackery that stretches back at least to the late 19th century, in the sense that this work tends to feature a simulacrum of scientific narrative at the rhetorical level. A lot of precise use of language. A lot of decimal points to evoke, Jonathan Marks points out in what it means to be 98% chimpanzee, that the power of the decimal point and you're giving a vague claim, the appearance of preciseness and scientificity.
That title meaning that humans share 98% of their genetic material with chimpanzees?
Right, exactly.
And what a difference that 2% makes, huh?
Right, which is John Marx's point, precisely. and frankly, he concludes his analysis of this work and these claims by saying that at the end of the day, we know just as much as we know exactly now what we knew about the relation between humans and chimpanzees 300 years ago, which is that in a lot of ways we're really similar, but in some very significant ways we're profoundly different. What you see in these narratives is the absence of what you might expect to be the real meat and potatoes of science, if you will, like attention to falsifiability, for instance. In the genes and political orientation work, it turns out that X and not X can equally be evidence of the genetic origins of politics. For instance, if you're a conservative and your parents were conservative, well, then that shows it in your genes. If your parents are conservative and you become a radical for a while and then become a conservative in your old age, and that also shows that your politics was in your genes. I mean, yeah, it's ridiculous. You know, this speaks to another problem. Well, it speaks to a couple of different problems that connect with ideology in a couple of different ways. I mean, one of them is that these communities of, you know, the latter-day genetic determinists are closed, insular communities. They don't read anyone else. They don't cite anyone else. They don't talk to anyone else. And it's also significant that none of them are really, you know, geneticists, right? I mean, this, you know, the related fields of evolutionary psychology and of the different, you know, strains of these people who are operating now in other disciplines. In fact, you know, I often have said that the only thing I can say about political science worthwhile is that it's not economics. But you know, sociologists, you know, the American Journal of Sociology, for instance, had a special issue on gene social structure. It goes back to a really old observation that Stephen Jay Gould has made often, and Rosalind Rosenberg actually made in Beyond Separate Spheres back in the early 80s, that when egalitarian political and social forces have a momentum outside the university, then the pendulum of the academic work tends to swing toward interpretations that stress the role of a nurture or a culture in explaining human difference and inequalities. And when anti-egalitarian forces have momentum outside the academy, then the pendulum, you know, within tends to swing in the other direction toward different kinds of, you know, determinist accounts, right? And determinism just seems to make more and more sense. One entailment of that observation is that in spite of the fact that, you know, so many scholars, especially in the social sciences, like to think that they can shape public policy by either whispering in the prince's ear, there's a lot of hope now, of course, among liberal academics, you know, the closer you are to the University of Chicago, the more such hope there is, or by cracking the op-ed pages of the New York Times and Washington Post. The fact of the matter is that they're just as likely, in fact, more likely to be influenced and to have their own thinking shaped by what's on the op-ed pages of the Washington Post and by the ideas of the ruling strata or the ideas that form the common sense of the ruling strata in the society at that moment.
This is also related to what we were talking about before I press the record button, which is politics without politics. Could you talk more about that?
Yes. That's one of my grandest, you know, frustrations of the moment. This has been a dream. Of course, it's a dream that's as old in American reform life, one might even say, you know, Anglo-American, you know, reform life, as the turn of the 20th century. You know, the strains of American collectivism, both socialist and progressivist, you know, like the Fabian counterparts, partly in a response to anxieties about the specter of active class conflict. That was associated with Marxism at that point. You began dreaming the dream of finding ways to rationally, without conflict, make a better world, make social democratic order, by convincing the upper classes that it was in their interest to do so. In the last 25, 30 years, we've seen an increasing development of a view that it's possible to have, what Bowles and Weisskopf and those guys used to call, you know, win-win political strategies, right? That you can paper over or sanitize or sidestep class differentiation, once again, by finding a technical fix. I mean, in some cases, it's, you know, with the Obama crowd, it's greenness, right, or green jobs that will restore the post-war moment of seemingly not, you know, non-conflictual economic growth that lifted all boats. As Judith Stein, you know, points out in her forthcoming book on the 70s, Carter had a moment like that too. It was called Sin Fuels, which people probably under their mid-50s don't recall. But, you know, this was going to be another one of the technical fixes that would produce growth that would make it possible to distribute proceeds in a way that got everybody off. Since then, I mean, I think another strain that's fed into this is shows up clearly in the fetishization of something called community organizing that we see around the Obama fan club, as you, I think, deserve credit for first describing it aptly. and it's a sense that I mean, over the 80s, with the retreat of the labor movement, with the collapse of the left, what we find more and more over time is a sort of foundation-funded approach to making social change. That, and I think this, frankly, coincides neatly, you know, all too neatly, with the cult of youth activism that sees sort of making political change as an abstraction that one pursues for its own sake without regard to, you know, direction or change on behalf of what interests, or and it's partly also an outgrowth of a pursuit of social action for purposes of self-fulfillment, which used to be, you know, a psychological thing or a spiritual thing, but increasingly over the last 20 years we've seen the growth of a sort of third sector political economy, which also makes sense as the state sector increasingly shrivels and retreats from doing its job. That connects, in which doing well by doing good takes on more than an emotional or a spiritual or a psychological payoff, but a material one as well. So we see now, under the auspices of a view that, in fact, it's not even argued for. It's a predisposition, ultimately, a preemptive predisposition that seeking to pursue a politics based on conflict is obsolete, it's outmoded, it's old-fashioned, it's unsophisticated. I think this is an orientation that increasingly has taken hold of the sorts of people who 25 or 30 years ago would have seen themselves as agitators in the public interest world, staff in the labor movement. And is now in this political economy, there are job descriptions of these folks who sort of move back and forth between the trade union staffs, public interest staffs, onto and off of congressional staffs or the DNC, and all bound by the dream that it's possible to make the world a better place, to pursue significant change, without any conflict. I think this also connects with the fanciful notion that it's possible to change the world without taking power, I believe, as John Holloway's book puts it. And, I think this all just kind of fits nicely, or comes together nicely, from their point of view anyway, in the Obama administration's approach, right? I mean, you know, the notion that the really sophisticated politics is the politics that begins with finding ways to appeal to the people who are on the other side of the aisle from you. It's just one that doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever. I mean, and I think where it becomes especially laughable, or where it becomes at least laughably obvious, is in this canard that was flying around for a while when Obama was putting his staff group together about the model of Lincoln, and the team of rivals, I believe he called it, which is a funny way to think of Lincoln, whose entire presidency, after all, was consumed in a civil war. I mean, I don't.
But he wasn't making a common cause with Jefferson Davis, was he?
Not so much you'd notice it.
I'm speaking with Adolph Reed, who is a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, a columnist for The Progressive magazine, and a frequent guest on Behind the News. But speaking of another president, I was just reading the speech that Roosevelt gave in October 1936, in which he was describing the enmity of the rich towards him, and he said, "I welcome their hatred." It's very difficult to imagine Obama uttering a line like that.
Well, yeah, it seems it'd be very difficult for him, for him to to say it, especially considering the rooms he's operating in, right? Geithner, Summers, and this is another oddity, Doug. I mean, I've actually been in the presence of people who are, long-term, hard-bitten, public interest world activists who you wouldn't expect to have much in the way of illusions, who I've heard lamenting that if we could just find a way to get past those Clinton people that Obama appointed to run the economy. It's bizarre, but I guess, when you stop to think about it, not entirely surprising that this king and country line would have taken hold the way that it has among so many people who think of themselves as progressive or left of center, because this is what Obama's shtick was. This is what his job was. This is what he gives them that, gives the ruling class, to put it crudely, that, not even Clinton gave them.
Yeah, it amazes me that the assumption is that someone as clearly intelligent and politically sophisticated as Obama doesn't know what he's doing when he appoints people like Geithner and Summers. It just boggles the mind.
Well, you know, I mean, I've wondered aloud about this as well, as to whether, you know, there's not a funny kind of racial paternalism operating there, or condescension. I guess, as we were talking before, I mean, you know, one of the arguments I'm trying to work through for this book is how important it is to make sense of the logic of the logical evolution of post-war racial liberalism to make sense of Obama. But the sense that because he's black, he therefore has to be progressive, unless he, you know, comes out as a conservative, then means that, well, then he can't know what's going on. Or, well, you know, because he's fundamentally progressive, then he surely can't support what these guys are doing. But that's only a half step away from accepting that he's just a black symbol, you know, not even Putney Swope, as it were, and that to that extent he's a cipher and just isn't talking to the right people. And granted, I mean, there's always a bit of that. I mean, it was like this. I was like this with the Clintons too. I mean, you know, the more or less sycophantic, you know, forces who, or elements who would like to be able to whisper in the prince's ear, are, you know, naturally inclined to think that things could just be better if, you know, they could whisper in the prince's ear. But that's precisely the king and country ideology, right? I mean, I guess the bottom line is, I mean, I do agree with you. I mean, that it just is, in one way or another, mind-boggling. Maybe I'm straining to find partial explanations of it, but how you can insist on the one side that this guy is so smart and so capable, and then on the other, that he didn't know what he's doing. I mean, this is either some form of condescension or the willful blindness of the hopeful dupe, or, you know, maybe some combination of the two.
We've only got a couple of minutes left, but I do want to touch on the issue of crisis. We are in the midst of some kind of economic and financial crisis. We still don't know the dimensions or the duration of it, but it's obviously not just your ordinary garden variety recession. What does that do to our politics, do you think?
Well, I tell you, one reason I've been waiting for the Left Forum for a month is to be able to hear your analysis of the economic aspects of the crisis. I think that from the standpoint of the left, again, which is, you know, who it's still nice to try to, you know, try to assume as the subject of a political action and as our audience, I think one of the dangers to avoid, and it's another one that's as old as the hills, is that there is no moment of objective crisis, or at least not in the political sense. I'll proudly expose Frankfurt School roots here and suggest that crisis is ultimately a political category, and that the tendency that so many Marxists have, of a sort, have fallen into over the decades, to try to anticipate, to plot, you know, the moment when the economic system goes into collapse, are fundamentally misguided. And I think especially now, I guess one of the compensatory virtues of powerlessness that one is able to observe, you know, the way the game is being played out rather bemusedly on occasion. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, struck me is that this is the first global depression that's occurred in a condition of mass public information industry mediation. And it's just kind of interesting watching, you know, the shaping and the guiding role that, you know, that the corporate media are playing in interpretation of the crisis and in containing it and you know, whatnot. And I think, you know, a flip side of, or first cousin at least, of the wish that, well, the sort of objectivist pathology that doesn't leave you any place except, you know, to hope that the masses, that abstraction, will arise spontaneously and, you know, bring in a new order, or the charismatic leader will arise spontaneously and you bring in the new order, or for those left of center forces like the labor movement that have some institutional clout and weight, it seems to me that the impulse has has been more just to kind of drag along and drag along and hope that something happens in a magical way. And this, by the way, is also, you know, an instance where the win-win and the, you know, cast of mind and the pathology of Alinskyism, you know, under whatever guise, you know, play a role too, that it's kind of easy to put your head in the sand and keep doing the same thing over and over again and hope that something, you know, that's somehow going to spark a magical moment. I think, and maybe this is a good place for me to end, but I think that, that a much more reasonable way for us to think about this, and I guess this isn't surprising for anybody who knows what I've been doing for the last 15 years or so, but is to start investing in trying to build a working-class-based political alternative. I mean, I think, you know, the party of the left in Germany is a very interesting development. I think the anti-capitalist party in France has developed is a very interesting one. I understand there are comparable things going on in Italy, and we all know what's been happening in Latin America. And I think the fact of the matter is, you know, to be kind of blunt about it, you know, the left, as those of us who identify with it like to think of it, doesn't have any ability to influence what this administration is going to do. I mean, we're weak, powerless, and in disarray. I think the labor movement has shown where it is, and it's in that much better shape than other less organized progressive forces. And I think it's important, imperative for, you know, those of us who are serious politically to start thinking about ways to try to build a credible alternative. I mean, yeah, it's not going to be anything that will influence, you know, the congressional elections or the next presidential election or the shape of what economic policy is going to be. And the most, but I think the most that we can do on those more immediate objectives is to try in whatever, you know, venues we have to bring pressure, you know, that's, and not sending emails to congressmen, but getting people in the street as much as possible. But the fact is we don't have much capacity to do that now either. That may have been a rambling answer, but I think it's the best I've got right now.
I've been speaking with Adolph Reed, who is a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, a columnist for the Progressive magazine, and who's working now on a book about Obama and his larger meaning for Verso, which will appear probably sometime next year. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this from Telepathy, who are a pair of women and their machines from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This is called Michael. Till next week, bye.